Father, you are gracious and compassionate, slow to anger, and full of steadfast love and faithfulness. And your eyes are on the children of men, and you see the way that we have organized, and even the ways that we've organized against you. But because of your relentless compassion, you continue to be involved and continue to pursue us. And we're thankful for that. Father, this morning as we're thinking about the city and what it is that, what is it that we're talking about when we talk about the city, I pray that you would give us clarity. And that you would give us charity of speech with each other. I pray that we would gain insight into your word. And it's in the name of your son, Jesus, that we pray. Amen. All right. So just first off, tell me, what's your favorite city that you have ever visited? Has anybody ever been outside Maypearl?
Not fond of cities.
I like Gatlinburg, Tennessee.
Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Why?
I just got
a lot of stuff to see.
As you said, it's a first shop and a whatever it is.
Tin top shop.
And then
it's a factory.
But it does, and did have a good resale shop, not a resale, but a
who else?
I thought Colorado was outstanding. I mean, I've not been to that many cities, but I'm talking about the state. Where we stayed was, it was up in on the deck where it was a three-story house, and we'd sit out on the deck. It was like you were just right there in heaven. These clouds come through this valley, just roll over you. I mean, it was the most beautiful sight I'd ever seen.
It's even prettier when you're in an enormous three-story house.
Well, it wasn't ours. It was a friend of Francis, but it was worth going and cool. Goodness. And it was so hot here. It was in August when we went.
Okay.
I'd have had a little something to do with it.
Anybody else have a favorite city?
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C. Why?
There's so much history there.
Do they have history there?
Oh. They're taking it all down, let me tell you.
I think for me, it's Salt Lake City. We went on vacation there once. They've got a dinosaur museum that's just fantastic. And it's not too far from Park City, where there's an Olympics training facility. I guess they did the Olympics there at one point. Local pizza was really good. They're not known for their pizza, but the one that we went to was really good. So anyway, Salt Lake City. I think that's my favorite. What's the smallest city that you've ever visited? You can't say Maypearl. Passing through doesn't count. You have to actually visit it. What's the smallest city you've been to?
Juneau, Texas.
Juneau, Texas. Population? Do you know?
No, I think they closed it down when they closed down the school in the 90s.
Okay.
It's more or less a ghost town. Just a few homes and farms and ranches out in the outlying area.
Okay.
They still got a post office there, but it's like a little bit of thing.
Well, if they've got a post office, then they're in business.
Well, the town closest to Grand Saline was called Fruitvale.
Fruitvale?
Fruitvale,
V-A-L-E.
Bell School, post office, and a convenience store. A caution light.
Smallest town.
Placid. Placid, Texas.
Okay. Do you know the population?
I'm thinking maybe 50-something.
Okay. 50-something.
I don't think they have.
You're starting to raise the question of whether it's a city or not.
I know. That's where my husband's sister lives. His sister-in-law. Near Brandon.
When I was in college, my boss, I worked at a bakery, and my boss was part of a rotation of preachers that he would go every, fourth Sunday of the month out to this little church in the little town of Payden, Oklahoma, and he would preach for them. And there was one week that he was supposed to go, but he couldn't, and he knew that I was studying Bible at Oklahoma Christian, and so he asked if I would go fill in for him. And I thought, yeah, I can do that. And so I had to do Bible class and preaching. And then when I got there, I found out I also had to do the prayers and the welcome and lead singing. And there were 9 people in that church. I don't know how small the town was, but the town was not very big. And the church was 9 people on a busy day.
That reminds me of when we were in preacher school. It's a little place in West Texas called Boyd Mountain. And you know where that? No, it's outside of Snyder, if anybody knows where that is. But anyway, same thing. They supported us $100 a month, and there were maybe 10 people in that little congregation, farmers, and same thing. And it was funny because we took our friend one time with us that was in preacher school with us, and James told them they were old people and couldn't hear, so he shouted the whole sermon. And then the people said, there's something wrong with him. He's so loud. Anyway, same deal. Had a little singer.
There's a little stone church of Christ going out toward the. There's a suspension bridge on the Colorado River called Regency Bridge, and they took it out when Bush was the governor of Texas. He rededicated it. And I mean, it's on gravel road, big cable.
Well, when I walked into that church at the ripe old age of 21 years old, I probably brought the average age of that church down by about a third. I don't know if that's possible mathematically. But. So somebody mentioned, I think Danette mentioned a town of about 50. It kind of raises the question, what makes a city a city? Does 50 count as a city? Say again?
You defined that the other day, and it had something to do with the amount of government that it had. And
so it has to have city government? Okay.
But you have, even towns and villages have government, a city. But it's not, I think it's specialization and the diversified economy. I mean, I come from the Panhandle. There's lots of towns up there, but they're very few cities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Bible uses the word Ir, which means city, I-R. And it can refer to a really small group of people. Beersheba that we looked at. It was one of our sites, had about 200 people at one point, and it's called a city. So I don't think a city has something to do with some sort of population threshold. I think it has something more to do with the structures and the purpose of the community. There's an interesting passage in, it's either Leviticus or Deuteronomy, about a walled and an unwalled city. Everywhere except in that verse, it seems that the word city in the Bible refers to a walled community. But right there you have an ear that it doesn't have a wall. So anyone who describes a city as, well, it has to have a wall, that doesn't make sense to me. Okay, so here's how I kind of want to get at answering this. We moved into our house in May of last year, so however long that was, 14 months ago. And when we moved in, the lot across the street from us was just a field. And we saw people come by and get out and like walk the field and kind of look at it. And it seemed like nobody wanted to buy it because it was the lowest lot in the entire subdivision and it's flood prone. We knew that. We're sitting up on a hill. We're looking down. I can tell why nobody wants this lot. But eventually, they came out and they bush hogged it. They cleared the land and they put a sold sign. Is there a house there? Because they bush hogged it? No. Okay, so a little while later, they come out and they mark off the foundation of the house. And they put up the forms for the foundation. They trench out in the dirt. They lay some plumbing and they pour the concrete. Is there a house there now? No. Okay. A little while later, they drop off a whole pallet of 2x4s and whatnot. And they frame up the whole thing so that it kind of looks like this. This isn't a house. But it kind of looks like this. Does a house exist yet? It's trying. But you can't live there. Right? You can't plug in your fridge. You could sleep there, but you'd be camping because it's not keeping you out of the elements. So a little while later, somebody comes in, they rough in the electric and the plumbing. Does a house exist yet? Like, at what point? At some point, we got to where we have neighbors living across the street, and there's definitely a house there. Make no mistake. But like, at what point did it become a house?
It was finished.
When they moved in.
When they moved in. When it was finished.
A home then.
Hmm?
It became a home then. It was a house when it had walls and a roofing on the top.
So I would argue that it became a house when they got a certificate of occupancy to say it's done.
I like what he said, because you'll see signs that say homes for sale. You don't sell a home.
You sell a house.
You sell a house and then you make a home.
Yeah. Which raises, like, how many kids have grown up in a house but not a home?
Yes.
I know I have a professor of counseling that said he will tell people to draw the blueprint of the place where they grew up. And then they can talk about the sights and the smells and try to like remember and go back into their childhood. And sometimes people don't draw the house that they grew up in because that's not where they grew up. That's not home. They'll draw their school or they'll draw a workplace or something. So a house can look different from one to the next. They have essentially the same materials. But what makes a house is that it functions as a house. Like Larry said, when people move in, when you can live there, it's a house. You have to be able to live there for it to be a house. And it's the same way with cities. A city may look different from one to the next, but they have certain components. You know, they have people, they have buildings, they have roads. But what makes a city is not the materials. It's the function that it serves. Okay? What makes a city is the functions that it serves. And so, what function does a city serve? And here's kind of my premise. Cities emerge out of a need to manage food. That's underneath it all, if you can get down to like the root underneath, down here somewhere, the reason a city exists is to manage food.
Most cities were built near rivers.
Most cities are built near rivers. They're built
water
near
sources.
Near water sources. You got to have water. Now, you could build it out near a spring. Jerusalem doesn't sit on a river, but it sits on the Gihon Spring.
Also, that's transportation.
But transportation, exactly. So port cities don't necessarily have a river, but they have transportation. You can ship, you can engage in trade and so on. So a few weeks ago, we looked at Beersheba, and we saw an aerial photo of the whole thing. I should have put a picture up here. But it was 2.8 acres, and it's like 300 to 500 people lived in this city at one point. You guys remember the town? And there's the big water system that you had to walk down the spiral stairs. And okay, so that city, when they were excavating that, they have all these layers. And the further down you go, the further back in time you were going. And when you get down to the bottom layer, the earliest people living at that site, what you have are just holes that are hewn out of the ground by hand. And they're, I don't know, 15, 20 feet wide, something like that. And there's evidence that that's where they stored food. We don't have evidence of houses. Doesn't mean they didn't have them, just means we didn't find them. But it seems that when Beersheba started, it was just people banding together to pool their resources and try to survive together. And that's part of, that's like the form and the foundation and the plumbing under the house. That doesn't make a city, but you have to have that. So a city begins to exist when multiple families band together to pool their resources. And the emphasis here is on multiple families. You can't have just one family that exists in four or five or six households that all live together. Then it's just a compound. If everybody is related to everybody, it's not a city. Joe Porter said that when he started to come here, people would walk up to him and say, "Who are you kin to?" Nobody's ever walked up to me and said, "Who are you kin to?"
You're a foreigner.
I'm a foreigner. When a community grows, one of the things that happens is you have many families, and you rely less on family connection and more on like work connections or other types of social bonds. And we'll talk about that later. So you have these families that band together. Imagine a time when we're way before pre-industrial revolution, or the way pre-industrial revolution, before the Renaissance, before the Roman Empire, before the Babylonian Empire, all the way back to the first time that people started to band together. The world population is still very, very low. And say you have two or three families off in one corner, and they band together, and let's just assume, for the sake of the illustration, that they know how to farm. And so you see these three little houses that are built near each other, and they're surrounded by their fields where they're farming. And as long as they only produce enough food for those three families to survive, you'll never have a city. What you need to have is more than enough food. And so a city begins to exist when the community produces more food than is absolutely necessary. So
there can be periods of time where they can't do that, where they can't even provide for themselves.
I didn't hear the beginning.
There are times when even cities can't provide for themselves. They go through drought or siege, from an enemy. So that's not always true.
Well, the interesting thing is, think about like Mariupol right now. There's not enough food to go around. And what's happening is the city is ceasing to exist. A city produces more food than is necessary, and when it can't do that, it crumbles and stops functioning the way that it should. Now, if they are to revive as a city, you eventually have to get to where you are farming again, and you have enough to go around.
But people in cities don't generally farm.
We'll get there. We'll get there. You're getting ahead of me. Okay, so you have these three families, and they're surrounded by their fields, and they're producing now more than enough food. And so I don't know how much is a bushel? Does anybody know?
It's like 56 pounds.
Okay, so let's say a family of 10 needs how many bushels in a year? Say a pound and a half per person times 10, they need 15 pounds per day times 360. Okay, they need about 80 bushels, something like that. Let's just pretend that you need 80 bushels for that family to survive. But they produced 100. They produced 100 bushels of food. What happens to the other 20 bushels?
You develop that farm to market road and take it to
them. You can develop a farm to market road, and you go and you trade. Or you can hew out a hole in the ground and store it for when there's a drought, famine, or somebody gets injured and they're not able to work, but they still have to eat, that kind of thing. So you have more than enough food. Now, let's imagine the same scenario, but instead of three families, let's pretend that it's now 20 families. And they have all this land that they're producing all this food, and they're all paying into the common pot. They've got, you know, one barn that they've built, and they're all putting their food in this one barn. What problems do you see with that? What problems would you imagine
greed
might come about? Okay, greed. What would that look like?
One of them thinking, well, I got more farmland than you do. I deserve more of the proceeds when it's sold, or more spots in place in the barn to put it. Or
okay, so I deserve a bigger share of the granary than anybody else, or more than you do. That's one. It's another problem.
Somebody that didn't work.
Okay, somebody who hasn't worked. They're not paying into the pot.
Don't work as much. Don't participate as much.
Or contribute.
What do you mean by that?
Somebody does not contribute.
Somebody doesn't contribute.
Right.
That's a big problem.
They still want to reap.
So there's 20 families, and one of the families says, yeah, no, we'll just keep our 20 bushels and we'll put it in our pantry.
Or they say, there's all this food there, why should I work for it?
Okay. So
varmints, though, can get into it.
Yeah, so you guys have hit on all the key issues that I can think of. One of them being, what if I don't want to pay into the pot? And the other being, what if somebody wants more out of the pot than is fair? And who gets to decide what's fair? Because it's not like you have a city council that you can go to and complain to. You don't have a judge. You just have 20 families trying to survive in this world. So, this is why a city begins to exist when you have a shared government or law. So, I probably watch more TV than I should, but one of the kinds of shows that I like are ones where people are isolated from society. So, Lost was a big one like this. Under the Dome is like this, where you have a group of people who all of a sudden are just completely cut off from the outside world. They're stranded. And when that happens, there's the initial, like, trying to recover, and people are hurt or whatever. And then they come to the realization that there's a limited amount of food. And they start raiding the grocery store, or they start trying to pick the island clean or whatever. There's only so much food to go around. And who's going to decide who has how much, who gets how much? And someone will try to, in the best interest of the community, they'll step up and try to manage the food for everybody else. And then the question is, well, who died and made you king? Which is a really interesting word. King. So back to our 20 families, and they have their disputes over their food. So you have one family that doesn't want to pay into the pot. We'll just be on our own, thank you very much. Who is going to take that food from them and make them participate?
One with most guns, I imagine.
One with the most guns? I mean, yes, in some sense. Although it's probably not a gun. I very much doubt that it's a gun. But it would be something like, you share 10% of your grain, or I will kill you with my shovel. You will surrender your surplus to the community, or we will use violence against you. This is tax. That's what tax is. So who, that's how you extract from the farmer, is you threaten violence. Who is going to do that? It's the person who is most willing to use violence. This is why human governments are inherently violent. It's not like sometimes they rear up and get violent. Human systems are inherently violent. And I think the Bible has a big problem with that. And I think Jesus has a problem with that. And Jesus imagines a kingdom that is not run on violence, but is run on generosity and willingness and taking care of each other, neighborly generosity. So, for the human community to be a city, you need to have multiple families. It can't just be one large extended family. And they're banding together to pool their resources because they're producing more than enough. And then you have to have some system of government to kind of decide who gets how much and to make sure that people are paying in. And what that means is that you have some people who are working in an occupation that's not food production. You have a governor, you have a scribe, you have somebody who has a full-time job that isn't raising livestock or raising crops.
Well, but you haven't even talked about people with specialties like the blacksmith.
This is exactly where that comes in. Because when it's just the three families living together, who's making the tools? They are. Who's making the clothes? They are. They're all making their own stuff. But once you have people, you have someone whose job is to be a blacksmith, well, now they're not producing their own food. Right? So how are they eating? They're eating out of the granary. But they're not just charity cases. They have to pay for it with their labor. And so now you have the makings of like an economy. They're trading for food. All right, so you have blacksmiths. You have bankers. You have lawyers. You have government officials. You have
seamstresses,
military, potters, specialization of labor. Anything that's not food production is specialized labor. And I would say that once you have specialization of labor, now you have your certificate of occupancy, now you have a city. Okay, how are we doing? Kind of make sense? Let's translate this into something that maybe makes a little more sense. A city exists not just because there are enough people or enough buildings or the right kinds of buildings. A city exists when it functions as a city. And that function all revolves around food. And so there are these four areas. I'm going to call these the four pillars of the city. When multiple families band together, we have the makings of community. Cities, one of the things that makes a city different from a rural environment is there's much more complexity of relationships. In Maypearl, we ask things like, who are you kin to? But in Fort Worth, you ask things like, what do you do for a living? In rural areas, you have aunts and uncles and cousins and grandparents and children and brothers and parents. In the city, you have neighbors, you have customers, you have vendors, you have strangers, foreigners. It's more complex. And the bigger the city is, the more complex the community is. More dynamics you have to take into account. Would you agree with that? Y'all can push back if you want to. All right. When the community produces more food than is necessary and you have a surplus, now you have the makings of an economy. Cities are marked by a move beyond little house on the prairie, just subsistence farming. Cities have more than enough. They have margin. And so it's in the city that you have trade, you have commerce, you have business, you have dreams and aspirations. You're trying to... I got this survey from the city of Venus, because I technically live in Venus city limits. And they sent out a citizen survey, I don't know, maybe a month or so ago. And one of the things they asked was, what kinds of businesses do you want to see Venus try and recruit? And all I could think was, man, mom and pop shops. I would love to see Venus become a place where small businesses can get started. What I don't want to see is mega conglomerations come in. In the city, as the city grows, the economy becomes more and more complex. Now, an individual family may just barely be getting by. They may not have surplus. And I think the prophets of the Old Testament are very aware of that. But the community as a whole has more than enough. In fact, one of the things that the prophets are often concerned about, I think especially about Amos, is the people at the top have way more than they need, and the people at the bottom don't have nearly enough.
And they're using injustice to get there.
And they're using injustice to get there.
They are exploiting people and denying them the rights, landlife rights.
They lie in bed at night dreaming up new ways to extract.
It's not just a matter of them not giving them, the goods away to those who are indigent. They're actually exploiting people, and there's injustice. And that's what the prophets rail against.
Yeah, and it's not just injustice, it is a justice of their own making, that they are deciding for themselves what is fair rather than listening to Torah, what God has said, this is how it's supposed to work. And so in any way that human governments and communities organize themselves that doesn't square with the Torah is by definition injustice. That's one of the things that the prophets, I think, are trying to communicate. And this goes back to the issue of like what happens if a city doesn't have enough, not just an individual family, but what if the whole community no longer has a surplus? The city collapses. When you look at Jerusalem, Jerusalem falls in the year 587 BC, and when it falls, they're out of bread. So one of the things that you have to, one of the realities that you have to navigate in the city that you don't have to navigate when you're just three families staking it out together out in the wilderness is the market. You have to learn how to navigate the market. buying and selling food and tools and clothing and healthcare and vehicles and animals and all this stuff. And like Maypearl has a little economy, but for a long time, especially like cotton gin era, the way that Maypearl survived was that farm to market road. Because we have more than we need here. We have way more cotton than we know what to do with, but we'll go and we'll trade it with the city. And so in doing that, Maypearl was already becoming part of the Metroplex. They're already, because if they said, we're not going to do business with Dallas, or we're not going to do business with Mansfield, then, okay, well, enjoy all of your cotton, and you'll never have clothes. Or I guess you could have clothes. You can make your own clothes because you have plenty of cotton. But you won't have tools. Nobody out there is making tools. That kind of thing. Is that making sense? Okay. Occupations other than farming. When some people have jobs other than farming, then we see industry. Cities are marked by the presence of people who don't farm or raise livestock. Manufacturing, healthcare, banks, craftsmen. This is crass, but even something like prostitution is an occupation that's not food production. It's a way that somebody is putting food in their mouth. And then government. Before we get to government, one of the realities that we have to navigate, and more so, the more connected to the city you are, is how do you respond to people who don't produce food? Paul has this statement in, is it Thessalonians? One of his Thessalonian letters about if a man will not work, he will not eat. Right? Who is he talking about? Is he talking about the guy at the bottom of the pool who broke his leg or whatever, or is he talking about the guy at the top of the food chain who doesn't work but he still eats because he's holding the biggest shovel or the biggest gun? He's talking about the people at the top of the food chain. Government, law. That's where we see government. That one wasn't surprising. A city is marked by some community members having authority to make decisions for the group. And so one of the realities that you have to navigate in the city is the existence of government and law and violence. Okay. How are we doing?
So when you say, what's your favorite city? Well, I like Vienna because it's beautiful. But on the other hand, it's a city. So you get all of the, it has the same feel as London or New York City or even Washington, D.C. The second thing is, for many years, I don't know how it is now. I used to live in Fort Worth. Fort Worth was a little town that got bigger. The atmosphere, the culture was totally different than Dallas. And Dallas was a city. And so I found your observation, your example of Fort Worth interesting because having lived down here for almost 50 years, I would say that, well, no, Dallas is a city, but Fort Worth is sort of maybe kind of, but not really. Anyway, but the other one is you're now getting into the wiki thing that comes into my personal belief, and that's that the role of government is not to deal with the poor. The role of government is to provide safety and to punish the evildoer or whatever. But the church's or an individual Christian's role is to care for the poor, is to care for the sick. And I really believe that. I think one of the things that happened in the 60s was whenever the government brought in not food stamps because it was commodities then, but but try because the church and Christians were not taking care of business, then the government stepped in, and they're huge, they're unwieldy, they cannot do it like we can do it in our community to take care of people in our community. That takes knowing what's going on, for one, and just seeing out and reaching out to people that maybe are uncomfortable reaching out to. But that for centuries, the church was responsible for education, for health care, for feeding the poor, taking care of business. And the reason why government stepped in is because the church, or Christians, or the church in general, or Christians, were not doing that. They were saying, well, Parker, we know your kids are hungry, but, you know, go get a job, work at it. There was no compassion, there was no, what I think we are commanded to do. We're commanded to care for people who can't care for themselves. Anyway, that's my personal opinion, and I think pretty strongly about it. Then you'd be very far.
Well, with the time we have left, let me make a few observations about where I think Maypearl is headed in light of the things that we talked about. And next week, we're going to get very deep into Bible. We're going to be doing deep Bible the rest of the time. But we needed a definition to start. So, a few things to expect. First of all, you can expect your relationships to get increasingly complex. And what I mean by that is you may have a certain number of relationships that are family and a certain number of relationships that are not family, but they're church friendships, they're work friendships, they are, I think for our young families, there'll be school and soccer and that kind of thing. And what we can expect is more and more non-family relationships. We can expect then the influence of the family to be diluted. I'm not saying that's good. I'm just saying that's a reality. Mom's voice will become just as loud, but it's going to be surrounded by other voices, more and more voices of other friends and employers and all this stuff. And the influence of the family is just going to be less. You had a close relationship with your family growing up, and you continued to be close even into adulthood, and maybe you thought, well, your kids are going to be just as close with you as they were with your, as you were with your parents, but that hasn't been the case. Because they went into the city, and they pulled away, and they got rooted into other relationships. This is part of why we want to be a church from April. We want to be a church family from April, to be a family for people who don't have family or who aren't connected to their family. We want to be a family that is knit around the person of Jesus. Expect more privacy, which is also the same as more anonymity in some ways. That's it. I'm out of time. I had six more, but there you go. I'll explain more privacy, though, before I let you go, because there's nobody milling about out there. Through, you think about our young parents that are up in Joshua's class right now. Through their connection to the school and sports, how many people do they know in the community? Like a ton, right? They know a ton. And they go to the Maypearl fireworks downtown. They bump into a bunch of people that they know because they know a large percentage of the community. If you know 150 people, you know a large percentage of the community. But as the community grows, the percentage doesn't stay the same. The number of people you know stays the same. And knowing 150 people in Dallas is very different from knowing 150 people in Maypearl. Right, and so that's what I mean by an increase in privacy, an increase in anonymity. an individual's drama is going to be less public. I don't know who is on Facebook, who looks at Voice of Maypearl. When somebody is upset about a pothole, they get on Voice of Maypearl and they make a complaint, or somebody's dog is out or whatever and they complain, and the whole town sees it. That's going to be less and less true. Those people are going to have less and less of a voice. Because in Dallas, you got, what, 3 million people or whatever? Nobody cares about this dog that got loose. Nobody cares about that pothole on your street. You're a voice crying in the wilderness. Okay. I guess that's all I got. Next week, we're going to have to move even faster, because next week we're going to look at the story of the Bible. We're going to start in Eden. We're going to look at Cain. We're going to look at Babel. We're going to look at Abraham. We're going to look at all the way to Revelation, and we're just going to have to. And we're going to see what's the story of the city in the Bible. Next, well, I'm not here next week. James is going to be teaching, and it's yet to be determined if James is going to teach the story of the city, or if he's going to do his own thing, and then we'll pick it up 2 weeks from now.